This is Micro News, the podcast where Matt and I...
Hello.
...talk about some of the times microbiology has been in the news this month. Happy New Year, listeners. We are back. It is 2021. New Year, new news. As usual, we took a break from Micro News in December, and that means that we have an extra great episode this month, thanks to 2 months' worth of microbiology stories to choose from. I hope you're excited, listeners, because I sure am. Matt, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. So we often cover stories on the show about microbes we've known about for decades or diseases we've been trying to cure for generations. But this month, we're looking at a microbe we've only known about since 2003. Giant viruses are, as the name would suggest, large and mysteriously complex. Scientists still don't really know much about them, apart from they kill amoebas and algae. But new research suggests that they don't just kill their hosts, they may be able to keep them alive and become part of them. A couple of years ago, a postdoctoral researcher at Virginia Tech was trying to unravel the evolutionary history of giant viruses. He put a viral gene into a genomic search engine to try and find similar viruses, which he would then assemble into an evolutionary tree. He thought he'd get lots of viruses, but his top match was algae. He kept searching and getting more algae. He and his advisor, Frank Elwood, noticed a strange pattern. The viral genes in the algae samples had been subtly altered, as if they were being passed down from generation to generation as part of the algae genome. They surmised that giant viruses weren't simply infecting and killing bacteria. It seemed sometimes they were integrating their DNA into living algal cells' DNA. They ultimately found evidence of giant viruses integrating into 24 of the 65 genomes of green algae they studied. In one alga, Tetrabena socialis, 10% of its genes came from giant viruses. All of this suggests that giant viruses play an important role in driving the evolution of their host species, not just by preying on the weak, but also by supplying new genes. However, we still don't know much about giant viruses as a group. It's estimated that scientists have only catalogued a tiny fraction of the percent of the diversity out there. The next stage of the research is looking for more examples of DNA integration across other single-celled organisms, such as fungi and protists, that also might be infected by giant viruses.
For almost 20 years, a mysterious disease has been killing sea stars on the west coast of America. The symptoms of this disease include decaying tissue and loss of limbs, with sea stars losing all structure and almost melting into goo. The disease, called star wasting disease, has been devastating, with a massive number of sea stars affected. In 2014, researchers suggested a link between these deaths and a viral infection, a hypothesis which was discounted when the suspect virus vanished and the disease remained. In fact, after 15 years of research into this mysterious disease, it turns out that it is not caused by an infection at all, at least not a single infectious pathogen. Instead, groups of several different bacteria living around sea stars have recently been found to be the cause. The bacteria live millimetres from the skin of the stars, using up all of the surrounding oxygen and effectively suffocating them. This explains the difficulty of scientists to identify a cause of infection, as it's groups of bacteria and not a single pathogen that cause star wasting disease. No specific species or strain of bacteria needs to be present. Bacteria in the water surrounding the sea stars can vary, but more often than not, a group of bacteria called capiatrophs were present. These bacteria live in warm, high-nutrient environments, and capiatrophs alone do not cause the disease. They're usually teamed up with other bacteria that thrive in low-oxygen environments. Together, the bacteria would deplete the water around the sea stars of oxygen, causing them to waste away. Sea stars have small external projections on their surface called skin gills. They breathe by diffusing oxygen from the water through these gills. So, as you can imagine, a thriving group of bacteria around the gills using up all the oxygen causes the sea stars to suffocate. Unfortunately, when sea stars die, they leave behind plenty of organic matter for the bacteria to feed on. And then any nearby sea stars can fall victim to the same fate as these bacteria spread locally.
Can anything be done to stop the disease?
Not really. The bacteria thrive in warmer waters, so climate change may be playing a factor in the increase in star wasting disease over the past 20 years or so. In lab conditions, researchers have been able to prevent the disease by increasing the oxygen concentration of the water or by using ultraviolet light to kill off the bacteria. Neither of those seem particularly realistic in real-world conditions, though. We can't exactly pump a load of oxygen into the Pacific. But it is really positive that now researchers know the cause, they can begin to design mitigation strategies to combat the disease. Like maybe planting more seagrass or increasing seaweed to increase the oxygen supply in the water.
We've done a few stories on the show about microbes changing the behaviour of their host, like zombie fungus, but I don't think we've ever done any stories about hosts changing how their microbes behave. Now, just a warning, you probably don't want to listen to this story while eating, so maybe finish your food and come back to this one. A recent study has demonstrated that the burying beetle, Necrophorus orbicolis, alters the odours produced by microbes to prevent competitors from stealing their food. Burying beetles feed on decomposing animals, well-known microbial hotspots. As the microbes grow on decomposing animals, they release a huge number of volatile compounds. These compounds attract a succession of insects hoping to feed, which isn't good for the beetles. A freshly killed animal will start to give off a sulfurous smell as microbes start to metabolise proteins. These will attract burying beetles searching for mates. The pair then take the dead animal into an underground nest to act as food for their young. The beetles actually transform the animal carcass, and I urge you to look at the article after and see the picture. Don't worry, it's not that bad, because the transformation is amazing. They remove all the hair, make the carcass into a ball, and then apply anal secretions into the exposed skin. These secretions contain antimicrobials and microbes from the beetle's own gut. They change the composition of microbes on the carcass and make the odour given off different, tricking other beetles into thinking that the carcass is already far too decomposed for them.
Oh, okay, so they're like protecting their food.
It's really cool. I mean, genuinely, the photo is really cool because you just see this. I was looking at the photo for ages trying to work out what it was. There's like a dead mouse and then next to it is just this ball. I was like, is that the beetle? But it's actually the thing, they kind of roll it up into a ball and like put mud around it and stuff. It's really cool.
I also have an insect story. You and I have spoken about leafcutter ants on Micronews many times, but as a reminder for the listeners, certain species of leafcutter ants, or attine ants, farm fungus for food. They cut leaves and grass and carry them back to their nest. They then grow and cultivate fungus on this organic matter. It's the fungus, not the leaves, that the ants then use to eat. So these ants and their fungus farms are very microbiologically interesting and the source of a lot of research into the discovery of new antibiotic compounds. To protect their fungal crops, the ants will use antibacterial and antifungal bacteria to selectively grow the most nutritious fungus and avoid contamination. Different ant colonies use different species of bacteria, but researchers have now found that the bacteria used across the world all share a common metabolite. This metabolite, called actinomycin, is the first metabolite shared by geographically distinct attinine ant colonies. Actinomycin is an antifungal compound that is used in the ant colonies to protect their fungus. It's a promising compound in the lab, and it was shown to rid mouse models of Candida albicans, which is an incredibly medically important fungal infection. Unfortunately, actinomycin is too structurally complex to serve as a useful drug model at this point. But as technology continues to improve, maybe one day we will see it in medicine.
Scientists have been questioning whether a plant's microbiome is nature or nurture. The idea that a parent tree can pass on their microbiome has often been discussed, but the link has only just been proved in a study from Stockholm University. The study showed that oak acorns contain a large diversity of microbes and the seedlings inherit the microbiome from the acorns. The microorganisms found on seeds are often vital for the plant, helping promote growth and protecting from disease. Each plant species has a distinct microbiome, both on the surface and within its tissues. The microorganisms from the seed can even influence the microbiome of the surrounding soil, as they can create a barrier preventing or allowing other microorganisms to grow. The study is actually pretty impressive, as demonstrating inheritance of microbes under natural conditions is really challenging, as seeds are exposed to and dependent on their surrounding environment when they germinate, and soil is obviously chocked full of microbial life. So it's nearly impossible to differentiate between microbes that come from the parent tree and microbes that came from the soil. The researchers found a way around this by culturing the seedlings in a culturing device that allowed the oak to grow in a microbe-free condition, allowing them to be certain that the microorganisms came from the seed and therefore the tree. They're now looking to see which is the most important source of the microbiome, the environment or the seed.
Oh, cool. I never even, sounds silly, I'd never really considered plant microbiomes before.
Yeah, well, they are, it's all things like the rhizosphere and that kind of stuff as well. Whenever new microbes are discovered, and they say it was the rhizosphere from a specific plant, even though the rhizosphere is kind of surrounding the soil rather than the actual plant itself.
My final story, or in this case stories, discuss some work from our very own policy team. Last year was the Microbiology Society's 75th anniversary, and as part of a number of activities and campaigns we ran to celebrate, our policy team undertook a mammoth project named A Sustainable Future. This project examined the role of microbiology in achieving the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. Now more than ever, we are very aware of the role of microbiology in addressing global challenges. We're in the middle of a global pandemic, and without microbiologists, we would have no vaccines, no understanding of how SARS-CoV-2 spreads, or how it has evolved. But infectious disease control is by no means the only important area that microbiology is relevant. Microbiology can contribute to achieving the UN SDGs in many ways. Given the breadth of the discipline of microbiology, it can play a role in accomplishing almost all of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. Our policy project really dug deep into the SDGs and identified a number of key areas in which the contribution of microbiology is particularly significant. The project involved running focus groups with a number of microbiologists from around the UK and Ireland, collecting case studies from researchers whose work directly addresses these global challenges, and producing policy reports, including recommendations, on three key areas. These areas were soil health, antimicrobial resistance and circular economy, and they were published in December last year. A number of key points from the report have been picked up by the media since they were published, including the impact that Brexit might have on surveillance of antimicrobial resistance and the importance of using soil health as a measure of environmental health. All of the reports are free to read and published on the Microbiology Society's website, and I would strongly recommend taking a look. We will leave links to the reports, along with all of the stories that Matt and I have discussed today, in the podcast description below.
Thanks for listening. As Laura said, links to all the stories are in the podcast description. We hope you're keeping safe, and we'll see you on the next episode.